Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Today we're going to be taking a journey through the sky waves, if you will, with a man who spent 36 years plus flying planes. But he's got stories to tell, not only about what he experienced as a pilot and what it took to become one, but also about the industry itself. And we've all seen quite a few changes, even just in the past year, 2 years. So we're going to have a sense of adventure with a man who felt like he was born to that very component, Ace Abbott. And for those of you that looked at the show information, you would have seen the name of Alan Morris, but Ace Abbott is what you would be looking for if you wanted to find this book, The Rogue Aviators in the Back Alleys of Aviation. Ace, welcome to the show.
Well, yes, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you, Donna.
Well, Ace, this is a fascinating book because in your 36-plus years of flying, you have gone through such a phenomenal shift in the industry itself. But I want to go back to right at the beginning of your book because you dedicated your book to your dad, and you described him as a maverick pilot. What would that word maverick mean to you and to my listening audience? What would you want them to know about this term, maverick pilot?
Well, he was just a free spirit person who liked to break the rules occasionally. He did things in the little old airplane we had tied up in the back 40 of the farm I grew up on, like hunting deer and fox out of the airplane, and he would sometimes buzz the neighbors and riding on their tractors and scare the bejesus out of them. And of course, he was also a lover of fine alcoholic beverages, so he had a cider mill and he had cider barrels in the cellar, and he always invited the neighbors after he buzzed them off their tractor, invited them down to have a glass of cider. And he was just a very adventuresome type guy.
Well, you know, at the time your dad was flying, there was a lot more open field area. I mean, he came from a time frame where getting in these pilots, and you've got what you call the back 40 Taylor craft, and I have to chuckle because you said there's a bull, an Angus bull in the
yes.
background.
Yes.
So here are these huge, huge fields. And was your dad's era the time when they would sometimes take people up in the planes, pick them up, you know, they'd land in people's fields and they'd take them for rides, maybe charging 50 cents, a dollar a ride, something like this. It was an amazing time.
Well, that was barnstorming, and the barnstorming was in that era. The barnstorming actually started back in the 30s. It was popular in the 40s and the 50s, but he didn't do barnstorming because he had a blue-collar job along with running the farm and running his cider mill. He didn't have time to do that kind of thing, but he loved to get the neighbors down to take them up for a ride, and he would take them up and do a loop and do a spin, you know, try and get them sick and get them scared and have them holler, Harold, stop, don't do any more spins. But we used to take off on the back 40 after we got the hay in the summer, dodging woodchuck holes down the hill, and then we'd climb up over the valley where the old farmhouse was, and he'd start the flight with a loop followed by a spin, and then we'd go buzz some farmers, and he had a lot of fun with the airplane. In the winter he would put skis on it, and of course this was upstate New York where we had lots of winter, lots of snow, and put skis on it, and he'd put his brother in the right seat with the old .22 rifle, and they'd go out shoot fox. Not for sport, but for money, because in those days, fox pelt was worth $5, and that was almost a week's salary back in that era. But so he was, and I think, you know, I think what his lifestyle and leadership kind of set the mold for me. And when I got out of the Air Force when I graduated from college in 65, I went in the Air Force. And when I was in the Air Force, I engaged in quite a bit of stepping outside the box, if you will. Like, for instance, my first solo flight in the Air Force T-38 was in northern Arizona, and I was in the designated practice area, and I looked to the west, and I said, "That's the Grand Canyon. I'd like to get a closer look at that." So I just flew over there and flew through the Grand Canyon. Things of that nature. I did, when I was in Korea, I took my F-4 Phantom and buzzed the Army base where all the generals and their wives were having Sunday brunch, and that really stirred up the Army guys, because they hated the Air Force and the Army. The military folks are always at odds. You know, the Navy is trying to get more, and the Army is trying to outdo them, and the Air Force is trying to outdo them. So they weren't too keen on us Air Force guys anyway. And when we after we did the flyby down there, right in front of their officers' club, they were up in arms, and I parked my airplane back in our air base, and the squadron commander met me and said, "Hey, Ace, don't ever do that again. I know it was a lot of fun, but don't ever do it again."
All the time he was smiling and really glad that you did do it.
Exactly, right. He says, you know, he was basically saying, "Boy, I wish I had the gumption to do it, but I'm the squadron commander, so I can't." So
yeah, you can't get away with it, but you whippersnapper,
snappers, yeah,
can go
exactly
ahead and do it.
Exactly, yeah. I had a lot of fun in the Phantom, but I'm sorry, go ahead, Donnie, you got it.
Well, what I wanted to say is there were some things that you brought out in your book that I thought was I really found them quite interesting. Most of the time when people think of someone being a pilot, you just get in the plane, you just take off, that's what you do. But you were really at an advantage over a lot of young men because of the way your lifestyle was, and that you lived in a forested area, you were allowed to play, you developed what you called an internal compass. And
exactly,
one of the first things that you say is that that enabled you, it's an aptitude, that it's commonly referred to a situational awareness. Tell us about this, because I had no idea how significant that was to a pilot.
It's really interesting. Generally speaking, the lay public doesn't, but situational awareness is basically a sense of where you started, where you came, where you are now, and where you're going. And as growing up on the farm out in the country, trekking through the woods and across the fields and sometimes into strange areas, I always had to maintain awareness of how I was going to get back home. And so I always knew where north and south was, where I had been. I had a sense of where I was going and so forth. And this element of situational awareness, knowing where you've been, how long you've been going a certain direction, and how much longer it's going to take you to get where, is something that's really an integral part of being a pilot. And there are a few pilots who can really fly an airplane awfully well, and they're very engineer-like. They can understand all the complex systems of complex airplanes and so forth, but they never develop a situational awareness. We had one guy, one of the airlines that worked here in Fort Lauderdale, interesting enough, his name was Captain America, and he was a brilliant guy. He knew all the procedures, he knew the checklist, he knew the 727 as well as anybody, but you could put him over the airport, and he wouldn't figure out how to get it on the ground. You know, he didn't have that awareness of when you had to do certain things, and clearly that's a big part of it. But unfortunately, Donna, in today's new age, modern, high-tech airplanes that are so computer-driven, computer-oriented, the computers have taken a lot of that away from the pilots, because they're handling all the situational awareness, because they're telling the pilot exactly how far they've got to go, how much time, how much fuel burn, how much fuel they're going to have at destination, when to start down, et cetera, ad infinitum. And then they also, when something goes awry with the airplane and they have an emergency, is all they do is push a button or cycle a switch, where and they're turning the most of the operation over to the computer. And then, of course, along with this, the, as far as actually physically flying the airplane goes, the stick and rudder element of it, they're doing very little of that because, that once again, the autopilot's flying the airplane and they're sitting there watching the world go by. So today's pilots are generally speaking, not as adept at the basic stick and rudder ability to fly the airplane and maneuver the airplane when you have engine failure and asymmetric problems and things of that nature, as were the old pilots who would fly the airplane consistently. And while I'm talking about this, you probably remember, well, everybody remembers the Buffalo-New York accident, and that was the Continental 3407 operated by Colgan Air. That was a prime example of the pilot relying on the autopilot until the last minute, and then he disengaged the autopilot, and he mishandled the airplane. He engaged in severe pilot error with his stick and rudder activity, which caused the airplane to stall, go into a basically into a spin, and auger in. And the other high-profile accident that occurred not too long after that was Air France Flight 447 off the northeast coast of South America that went straight into the ocean. We all remember that flight?
Well,
at any rate,
I know it at the moment, but anyway.
On that particular flight, the two pilots in the front of that Airbus 340 severely mishandled the flight controls, and they had never flown the airplane, actually hand-flown the airplane at altitude, and they flew the airplane into a stall and kept it into a stall until the airplane splattered in the water, and it was another case of not having a feel for the airplane. But anyway, covered that one pretty good, Donna, so just want to throw that.
Well, one of the things that I think is so significant is that education and training and the hours of training that it takes to develop certain skill sets, these are things that you can't ignore. I know that I became acquainted with bush pilots. I've been up in Alaska going up there for a number of years.
Really?
And you have a chance
to
interact with bush pilots. And these bush pilots, many of them, they had to go through so much training because there are areas of Alaska where your instruments will not work.
Sure.
So you literally have to memorize areas of land, the layout, so that you can make sure that you're going to get to where you want to go. This is not a joke.
Yeah,
so
that's interesting you say that, Donna, because that's a prime example of having to maintain a high level of situational awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, those bush pilots, they have to be really good stick and rudder pilots because they're flying the airplane in unusual circumstances. They can't engage the autopilot and have the autopilot fly the airplane down to the runway and then have the autopilot automatically lower the nose, activate the speed brakes and thrust reversers. You know, they can't do that. They're flying that airplane from pretty much quite often from takeff to landing. So
they're
old fashioned pilots, if you will.
Yes, they are. But even if they have a modern-day plane or jet or whatever, they have to know how to move quickly and how to make judgments fairly quickly because Mother Nature is not necessarily forgiving in the air currents and, you know, weather and all kinds of things. So to me, it really takes a type of reflex and mental agility to be able to deal with variables. Now, you went into the Air Force, and you wanted to fly more than anything else. And I had to chuckle because you make a comment in your book that every pilot's first solo experience is stamped indelibly in the forefront of his or her brain, and remains crystal clear in the memory bank even after the onset of advanced dementia and Alzheimer's. I thought,
right.
When they figured that one out, then we can get rid of the other two, the Alzheimer's and the dementia. But that is an incredibly powerful statement.
Yeah, now I believe, you know, from my experience talking to all the pilots, almost every pilot will relate the same feeling that initial solo was an experience they'll never forget. And, of course, with me, as I described in the book, Donna, you know, I lifted off and started climbing out, retracted the flaps, and I looked in the right seat, and I says, wait a minute, there's no instructor pilot there. You're all by yourself, Ace. And I started engaging in what I will call a gentle laugh, which was a smug chuckle. I said, oh, my gosh, I'm up here in this airplane all by myself. Wow.
Yep. Now, when people train for becoming a pilot, and when you started, you had academic courses, of course, which yep. included meteorology, aircraft systems, aerodynamic principles of flight, various training scenarios. They didn't have simulators at the time that you started out, but they also had quite an educational experience on decompression, rapid decompression, and hypoxia, which is inadequate oxygen, in the altitude chamber. And this is a room that can hold up 20 people. It's not unlike what they do with the divers that get the bends and what is it called?
Same situation, right?
Yeah, the same kind of situation. Now, I was amazed, too, to learn this. The blackouts that so often have been described by pilots, test pilots that go up to high altitudes and then do maneuvers and all of a sudden they black out. You say they really don't black out. What is it that happens?
Well, here's what happens when in a high-G maneuver, which usually is only sustained for a short period of time, Donna, the situation is the blood leaves the upper extremities and goes to the lower extremities, and it leaves the upper extremities. The vision, the first thing that goes is the vision, but the pilot can have blacked out, lost his vision, and still have a certain level of consciousness. It's not like he's dropped into a state of
unconsciousness.
He's not unconscious. He is not unconscious. Now, if he maintains that high G situation for a significant period of time, he will be unconscious. But basically, what will happen is as soon as he loses his vision, his vision blacks out. And it's kind of interesting because what happens, Donna, is it tunnels. You go from your normal vision to it's almost like looking through a spyglass, if you will, where you're closing up the aperture and you can see your field of vision breaks down. It's dark on the outside and you get a little small pencil thin view and then it's gone. But you're not unconscious at that time. You're only unconscious if you maintain that G force for I'll say at least several seconds more. But the situation is usually you're going to engage once you black out. The pilot is then going to release the back pressure, which will reduce the G's.
Now there is a group of pilots that are specifically chosen and trained to deal with nuclear weapons, and you call it SAC, Strategic Air Command. But the guys that go into this, they really are not excited about it. In fact, you got a photo in your book of a man that looks to be about 2,050 years of age, wearing an Air Force SAC uniform. And it says, "Sleep tight, America. Your Air Force is awake." He's got the helmet on. And it says, "The effects of nuclear alert on a young SAC pilot." And the psychological pattern is all of this. And most of us are not even close to being familiar with this particular environment of pilots, and you pilots really are an elite fraternity, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And the great thing about the elite fraternity, then, is that whether you're a SAC pilot or a F-4 pilot or 727 pilot, the guy that's flying his little puddle jumper Piper Cub, he's your pilot colleague also. It's a fraternity that encompasses all aviators everywhere, and there's just that instant rapport and camaraderie, because we understand that in order to be a pilot, and having gotten at least to a solo, initial solo, and so forth, that you have a certain right stuff, if you will, a certain substance, and then of course you also have that love and joy of flying. So you'll see airline pilots chatting with a little airplane driver and having great conversations, because there is a lot of commonality, even though flying the 777 from O'Hare to Paris is a lot different than flying the Piper Cub around the back 40. There's still the element of being a pilot and having control of your airplane, being in the air and controlling your air machine. And I think that's one of the bigger parts of aviation is the fact that particularly if you're captain, if you're the pilot in command, you're in control. You don't have you don't have a boss looking into your cubicle and saying, hey, get going on that project, and everybody else on the flight deck, whether it's co-pilot or flight engineer, they're there to help you. And that's what I enjoyed about my career is I was able to, if the weather was bad at the destination and I said, that doesn't look good. I mean, we weren't going to get there with much fuel, and I don't think it's a good idea. I could say, sorry, boss, we're not going. And to have that amount of control in your work environment is relatively rare, I think.
Well, and not only that, I think that it also speaks significantly when you are flying, even with all of the latest technology. Things can go wrong. You can have a weather front that's come in to an area. You can have turbulence. You can have parts go wrong, like you've had engines catch on fire and all kinds of things. This you must be trained for. You must be trained for these things, because if you're flying a passenger plane, it's not just you in the front seat. You've got maybe up to 200 and some odd people that are going to be in that plane whose lives you are responsible for. And you have some very interesting stories about that, but there's a couple of funny things, and I don't know that it's so funny, but you talk about a shark repellent, and you learned when they talked to you about the shark repellent that they had developed that actually sharks liked the shark repellent, so that it would attract sharks. That just did me in. I looked at that, and I said, oh, boy, who needs a shark repellent? Then
that was really funny. They discovered shortly thereafter, the John Cousteau people discovered, research of their own, that the shark repellent that the Air Force was handing out to their pilots actually attract the sharks.
They go, yum, yum, we got dessert here. Guess what?
Back,
we got some fresh
back to,
meat,
back
too.
To the old drawing Woo-hoo! Board. Back to the drawing board on that shark repellent. Eh?
That's right. Now, it was a very true statement, I feel, that you had in your book, that pilots, because you were preparing to go off to Vietnam, anyone that was being prepared, you had to really pay attention to what you were told, because having something in a classroom and actually being in an environment where you could be blown out of the sky, and thank you very much, but we have no simulator to take you out of this, it's a whole different ballgame.
You talk about
the refueling in air, and that to me has always been fascinating.
It was fascinating to me, and you might remember my first airborne refueling mission, as you remember, was somewhat catastrophic in that.
Right.
I won't go into it, but it was a situation where the pilot in the front seat, out in the back seat at that time, the gib, if you will, guy in back, he asked me to do the refueling, and I really hadn't had any experience in an airplane. It was one of my first few flights, and refueling, doing an airborne refueling, was way over my head, basically, and it ended up being an interesting situation. But and I had a few situations also in my later years flying the Phantom in the Far East, where I had some very terse encounters with a night airborne refueling. We used to actually refuel at night in the clouds, and that was usually a harrowing experience.
It required
two things. It required precision flying, number one, and it also required tremendous concentration, because you had to be totally focused on the task at hand. It was like carrier pilots, like the Navy and Marine carrier pilots that land on those carriers at night. You're just the level of intensity is so high about two-thirds of your potential adrenaline supply is used up by the time you get off the tanker after refueling at night. So it was exciting, but the pilots that flew a lot out of Vietnam, they did it almost every day, and they got to the point where particularly in good weather and clear blue skies, it was pretty routine for them. But in the environment I was working in, we didn't get to do it that often, so it was very challenging.
Well, and that's something, your stories about the Phantoms and how many were destroyed in the Vietnam War. You talked about snake school, which one had to go through before one could be a combat pilot. And you have a story about a man, Lieutenant Dengler. There was a movie made about him, Rescue Dawn.
Yep.
And just a phenomenal batch of stories in here that And you were considered at the time the youngest ranking F-4 Phantom aircraft commander in the U.S. Air Force. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's interesting, Donna, because I ended up in the right place at the right time. And when I finished pilot training and went into the F-4 Phantom, I had to start, as all of us did at that time, in the back seat as a second-in-command, or a GIB, as it was referred to, guy in back. Well, at any rate, the only way you could get to the front seat at that time was experience your 13-month war tour, and then you came back for a 6-month upgrade training program in California. Then you went back for your second war tour, and that's how you got into the front seat. Well, the squadron I ended up in, Korea and Japan, because right after the Pueblo incident, they needed F-4 Phantoms over there and F-4 Phantom pilots. So I ended up in Korea and Japan, and my squadron commander says, hey, we're going to take some of you guys out of the back seat and upgrade you to the front seat. So I immediately started playing golf with the squadron commander. And at any rate, as it turned out, I was the first guy in their squadron to upgrade to the front seat of the Phantom. At that time, I was still a first lieutenant, and I think I was the only first lieutenant in the Air Force that was a front seat F-4 Phantom aircraft commander. So that's my small claim to fame in my Air Force days.
And you talk about vertigo, and I don't think very many people are aware that pilots can be hit with this. And there are things that can go on within the brain, within the body, the nervous system. And it has to do with the inner ear and the way it connects with the brain, flight altitude. So there have been a lot of accidents when vertigo has affected a pilot. Of course, then they have to really be trained so that they orient themselves towards their instruments. I'm wondering if that's happened to pilots that perhaps have flown over the infamous area called the Bermuda Triangle and other parts of the world where they have had this hit them. And how in the world are you going to be able to work with that? I mean, this is really, this book is loaded not only with what I'd call the war stories of lifetime experience that you've had, but also some real realities that people have to deal with when they are pilots.
Yeah, I think just one of the reasons I wrote the book is I wanted to, inform the layman of all the incredible variety of situations and details that you have to learn and situations you have to deal with, along with, of course, my civilian flying was a radical roller coaster ride. I refer to it as rapid oscillations between the aviation penthouse and the outhouse, and that involved going from flying the Learjet to and spending spending a weekend at a 5-star resort in Bermuda, and then a week later the Learjet is sold, and I'm without a job, and I'm engaging in lawn maintenance and manual labor to survive. But back to the vertigo. Vertigo is basically when your inner ear tells you that you're in a different position than you're actually in. And I had vertigo in the tanker one night, and in the refueling tanker, and I was convinced, based on what my inner ear was telling me, that we were in an inverted, upside down position, 45 degrees nose low. And this was, even though my common sense told me we couldn't be in that position, that's what my inner ear was telling me. And it took a sneak peek away from the tanker at my instruments to verify that I was in fact straight and level, as opposed to in that horrific, dangerous 45 degrees nose low position. So tremendous numbers of flights. There's been thousands and thousands of airplane accidents that were a result of vertigo. You might remember John Kennedy. I think it was John Kennedy, wasn't it? Was killed in the small airplane accident on the way to Martha's Vineyard. And that was a case of vertigo. He encountered vertigo and basically lost control of the airplane because his inner ear was telling him something, was giving him some erroneous information, if you will.
Fascinating stories. Well, you go into your experience with the Learjet. You talk about the FAA safety regulations. You give an understanding of what pilots have gone through. You cover a number of different organizations that in the aviation industry have effectively just disintegrated and disappeared. You talk about so many different challenges, and I think, Ace, that your book is just mesmerizing in so many ways. And you've met so many famous people, but at the same time, you also had the experience when you were flying in for an airline group in Florida where there was drug running going on and all kinds of things. So it's really almost like an adventure book when somebody reads The Rogue Aviator. Now, you have a website called therogueaviator.com, therogueaviator.com. Information about the book is available. If you have anyone in your life, if there's a young kid that says, I'd love to be a pilot, okay, this is a book that's written by a man who has lived the experience on many different levels, everything from an F-4 Phantom to a little hokey-dokey ding-dong of a plane that maybe nobody's going to give too much attention to, but he can fly it anyway. I mean, everything in between. It is a phenomenal book that is really going to be an eye-opener, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. Ace, would you have a comment for my listeners before we say goodbye?
Well, yes. I would say have some fun. Grab The Rogue Aviator and read it, because it is a fun read. You know, the book is filled with a lot of satire, subtle humor, along with it's got as you can imagine, a fighter pilot would have and a career pilot. There's stories of decadence and debauchery in there, but there's also some incredibly interesting anecdotes that will get you on the edge of your seat with your pulse racing. And every pilot that has read the book has come back with a 5-star rating on it, because they really enjoy all the adventure stories. And anyway, it can be purchased directly from the website. I also have a blog that you can access off the website, and of course, it's available everywhere and anywhere that an ebook is for sale. Particularly, of course, Amazon. If you buy your books at Amazon, you can purchase the actual soft covered Amazon as well as the ebook at Amazon. So yeah, it's a fun read. It'll inspire you.
Yep. Ace, this has been great. I'm so delighted you were able to join me. Keep on flying. I just think you've got a lot of great stories. TheRogueAviator.com, that's the website. Check it out. It really is a good read. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com. and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says Glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says Glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz. Telephone lines are now open. If you have a question, a comment, you want to talk about dreams, what do you interpret? How do you interpret dreams? Whatever is of your interest, give me a call at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. The dynamics of various levels of industry are so much fun. But I think when we have someone like Ace, who has had, for all intents and purposes, what we would consider an adventuresome life, it's good to read about both sides, the adventure and the non-adventure, the realities of what you have to take care of, what you have to be attentive to, and everything else. I always have been fascinated with planes. We've got a neighbor who at the age of 70 decided he was going to become a pilot. And the training that he's had to go through has been quite rigorous. Now, he did serve in the Air Force, and he was a navigator in his younger years. But here he is in his 70s learning how to fly a plane. He's in excellent health. He's got wonderful vision. And so here you go. It's something that you can do, but there is a lot of training that has to go in for that. So it's a fascinating story, and I really enjoyed it. Well, I wanted to share some odds and ends of things with you today. And again, I want you to know that if you want to give me a buzz and let me light up your life for 2012, give me a call at 888-627-6008. Oh, before I forget it, tomorrow we've got Amy Amlers, and we're going to be talking about big fat lies women tell themselves. Amy's a doll. You're really going to enjoy it. So I hope you can join us. Ooh. Also, I want to be sure that I give the zodiac. Remember, I was talking yesterday about Cancer, Leo, and Virgo. So let's talk about three signs, Aries, Taurus, and Gemini. And this is a 2012 generalized horoscope for those under those signs. For those of you under the sign of Aries, well, you know what? You are going to find that fall of this year is really going to be opening some opportunities for you. And you know what? Family is just going to be so incredibly important. You are going to find yourself really feeling like you have got this wonderful camaraderie, interaction with people that are significant to you. And you know something? Lots of times when we think about family, we think it's bloodline, but sometimes our family includes friends. Have you ever thought of it that way? I do. As I find, there are many friends that I have. They are part of my family. And when it comes to success and money, stamina's the name of the game. You are going to find, because you are persistent, you are consistent in what you do, and if you follow your basic financial plan, you're going to be smiling every time you go to the bank. So you need to know that you can have that financial golden touch if you really plan well. You will be happy with the results. Those of you born under the sign of Taurus, relationships, wow, you're going to have to give them some tender loving care. You need to really ask yourself about the relationships in your life. Do you really want to have the links with them? Are there certain people that you need to phase out of your experience? Those people that you want to integrate into your environment even more, how can you give that tender, loving care, the old-fashioned TLC, and having open, honest communication with people? Now, honesty doesn't mean that you are honest in a negative way. You have to use your words with thoughtfulness, because words have power. They really do. So don't act like a bull. You need to be thoughtful. Not like a bull in a china shop when it comes to success and money. You need clarity. Apparently, there is some fogginess for those of you born under the sign of Taurus. Now, by golly, when you guys get focused, you just you know, you just go full steam ahead. You're right there. But you need to have the clarity. So if you're feeling a little vague about what your priorities are, you need to get that clear first. And then the rest of it you follow through with quite easily. And with your dreams, you know, I think you just need to realize that there's endless possibilities. If there's something that you've always wanted to do, maybe you've wanted to be on the dating game or whatever program is significant to you, and you say, oh, I'd love to do that. Maybe I'd like to be on the Martha Stewart show sometime. I want to go to New York. All right. Then look at options. Don't let the universe wonder what it is you want. Put it out there. Say, I don't know how it's going to materialize, but somehow it is. And just keep your open attitude about it. The universe is amazing, and your relationships, your harmony is really going to be good. Now, for those of you born under the sign of Gemini, when it comes to your love life, well, I think that you are going to be healing some relationships that perhaps have had a little bit of pain and suffering associated with them. But I do think there's going to be either one of two things. Either there's going to be a salve, an emotional salve that's going to smooth over the wounds and cause a healing, or you're just going to say, the line's cut, that's it, boom, you're out of the picture. Also, when it comes to success and money, if you're really wanting to move forward in a career, I believe that you're going to find this year is going to give you those opportunities. So for those of you under the sign of Gemini, realize that you've got to prepare yourself. If you're wanting to shift into a new modality, start educating yourself. Prepare yourself so that when you're ready to step out into maybe a whole new job position, could be something that's unknown to you, you're going to come up with that. This is what I've invested in. This is what I really love. This is what I'm exceptionally good at, and go for it. And then your dreams are really going to be fulfilled. And you're going to find that 2012 is a liftoff year for you, those born under the sign of Gemini. I just think that your love of romance, your love of beauty, you need to appreciate that and always nourish that inside yourself. You will be so much richer because you do. Well, that is three more signs, or I should say those are three more signs of the zodiac. So we've got six more to cover, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. So we'll be getting to that in a little bit. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. Before I forget, those of you in the state of Washington, Western Washington, Quantum 2 class is coming up January the 28th. I am so excited about this. Our first class, Quantum 1, was done back in November of 2011. It was so successful, people wanted another class. We're doing it. We're only able to have 25 students. Now, all the information about the location, the time, everything is on my website. If you would like to participate in this class, because it's a very interactive class, give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604, 253-582-5604. Send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com. The cost is $59.95, and if you pay in advance, it's $65 at the door. So do let me know. Let's get that reservation in for you. I've been getting calls. I'm just so pleased. So just get in touch with me. Also, backing up a little bit, the 21st of January, I'm going to be appearing at the Ascension into Light Foundation Center. We've got a very special event that Saturday evening from 7 to 9 in Seattle. And the address there is 1222 South Weller Street. And if you need more information, call 206-356-6356. And Melanie is the person to talk to, and the admission is $20. There's going to be four of us that will be presenting, and we are going to be giving insights into the year 2012, plus giving a little mini-talk. It's going to be a power-packed program. I hope that you will come. So again, Donna Sebo here. If you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I invite you to give me a call at 888-627-6008. There was a real cute story. There was someone that was interviewing some job applicants, and of course it had the applicants fill out a questionnaire. And there was a line, one question: choose one word to summarize your strongest professional attribute. And one woman filled in, I'm very good at following instructions. So that was something that impressed the interviewer. Anyway, Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. I wanted to share with you a wonderful story. We're getting ready to go on break in just a minute. So before I go and I do that, I wanted to just give you some tips. And these are some tips that I don't think are going to be new to you. But we're in a new year, and I would love to see you make some resolutions that are not, gee whiz, I'm going to lose 25 pounds. Look, this is stuff that you can talk about at any time, and you can work on at any time. But why not take a different approach? Why not say, what can I do for myself this year that's really going to add some pizzazz to my life? What about taking a class on a subject I've never done or been involved with? What about making a financial program, saving money? But what you want to do is you want to motivate yourself in a way of self-investment. So many times we put energy and effort into other people, and we don't do it for ourselves. So really take the time, go someplace, get a conference room at the library, go someplace where it's quiet, where nobody's going to bother you, and ask yourself, what could I do for me that is really going to make my life richer and make me feel like as a person I'm going to expand? A diet, you can start that in 30 seconds. If you don't want a diet, then just eating healthier. But really look at what you can do to invest in yourself. You're worth it. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic. Safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com. to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. There's a young woman named Lily. When I came across her story, I thought she really is an inspiration to anybody that she would come in contact with, because so many of us have challenges that we go through, and we feel like we're all alone and that there are no options for us to consider. And Lily was a young woman who really pretty much grew up without family around her. Her mom and dad both suffered from mental illness, and they were also involved with drug addiction. And that is a tough scenario. I've known many families where members have had these terrible, terrible environments that they've had to go through. And when they're little, when they're kids, well, like Lily, they're put into a foster home situation. And it can really, really be hard, because everything inside you says, I should be with my family, and yet I can't be. And you don't understand when you're little why mom and dad are the way that they are, or why it is you can't be with them. All you know is that you cannot. And her parents really were in a very, very bad situation. Well, one of the things that happened with Lily, by the time she was put into the foster home situation, she already was struggling with school. She loved school, but because of all the emotional turmoil that was going on in her life, she felt very lost. She felt so terribly, terribly alone, and school was so important to her, and she was so afraid, because when you're being put in one foster home after another, you never know where you're going to go to school. Well, she managed to do something that not a lot of young people would consider. She managed to talk to her social worker and said, I want to stay in the same school. I don't care what we do. I don't care what family you put me with, but please let me stay in the same school. Well, they managed to do that. It just was absolutely incredible. Now, Lily also found she was dyslexic. So she had an additional learning disability on top of all the emotional anxiety and stress that she went through. Well, you know, she was a very determined individual. She determined that she was going to finish school, and she had a counselor who was very, very supportive of her. And when she got into high school, when she started thinking about college, she'd get very, very excited. Well, her guidance counselor really, really encouraged her. And do you know what? This young lady got nearly perfect SAT scores. The counselor was just supportive. She didn't have family that was supportive, but this counselor was. And he got together a catalog of colleges for her. He said, now, this is what you're going to have to do. And she said, wow, look at all these different schools. They're just really top-notch schools. Well, down deep inside of her, her self-esteem and self-confidence was at the bottom of the barrel. She really didn't think it was possible for her to be considered, even though she had such outstanding SAT scores. So what she did, she said, I'll just apply. So she applied to these various colleges and universities throughout the country, and she also applied to state schools. And this was just going across the board. She said, I don't know if any of them are going to accept me. She had an essay that she wrote to determine whether or not she was going to be accepted by a college. And here's a couple of comments she made. She said, where I come from and where I'm going are two very different places. Well, she started getting responses. And she was accepted at Georgetown and Dartmouth universities, and she was stunned. She also got acceptance letters from Harvard and Princeton and Yale. Now, here is a young woman that came from the worst kind of environment, and she got 14 top colleges and universities that wanted her. So her counselor was continuously supporting her. The counselor said, you have worked hard, you have gone above and beyond the call of duty, and they want people like you in their school. So she decided to go to Yale, and she got a scholarship from a university and one from Foster a Dream, which was an organization that provides support to foster children. And she is on her way to New Haven, Connecticut. And she arrives there, and of course, she was scared to death, just absolutely scared. She met her roommates. She found out they were just as scared as she was, but she also found out they were very nice people. So she ended up developing some friendships. She had a 3.5 average, which she maintained all 4 years in college. And today she is in her middle 20s. She's attending law school. She's going to become an advocate for children in foster care. And this is what Lily said. She said, I want kids to know there's always, always hope for a brighter future, because it's true. Where you come from and where you go can be very different places. I'm proof of that. I think it's so important for us to read stories about the Lilies of life. The reason it's important is that we need to understand that where we are, if it's an uncomfortable place, if it's an unpleasant place, we don't have to stay there. And education is a resource that enables us to see many times opportunity. Lila has turned what would have been maybe a nightmare for many people, and was for her when she was small, into something that's leveraged a desire inside of her to help others that might find themselves in the same place. What was adversity, she's turned into power. And that's what we all can do as individuals. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. I hope you'll join me tomorrow. We're going to find out how we can really work with our minds, our attitudes, and our actions to make our lives richer and better, more than we ever dreamed. Donna Sebo here. I'll talk to you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com, Station 1. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.